Eric Drexler developed, named, and popularized the concept of nanotechnology 27 years ago. Now, in his latest book, Mr. Drexler outlines how nanotechnology could be used to manufacture products with a level of precision still unheard of today. And because the raw materials would be relatively inexpensive atoms, these products could be made cheaply, transforming our world from one concerned with scarcity to one of plenty. Radical Abundance, How a Revolution in Nanotechnology Will Change Civilization, is published by Public Affairs, and we are re-airing my interview with K. Eric Drexler from May. I began by asking him, we hear the word nanotechnology used all the time, but I suspect most people only have a hazy idea of what it means. Can you explain what it does mean?
I think that the first thing to know about nanotechnology is that the word doesn't, in fact, have a definite meaning.
Okay.
I
know what nano means. I know what technology means.
Yes. Nano refers to a billionth of a meter. It's a few times an atomic diameter. When I introduced the term, I used it to refer to technological systems, electronics, machinery on the nanoscale, and in particular ones that were built with precision, with all of the atoms in a specified place, as we see in well-defined molecules in chemistry. Atomic precision actually has a history going back more than 100 years. The term at this point refers largely to material science.
Wait, so
science.
We could say that nuclear weapons use nanotechnology on some level?
Not really. The difference between the nucleus and an atom, it's a factor of 100,000 in diameter. It's the difference between a huge cloud and a hard little piece of metal. Very different in density, very different in all respects, really.
I interrupted you. You were saying.
Yeah. So the term has come to be applied largely to material science, when in fact the greatest nanotechnology in the world today is the one we're using right now. It's the nanoelectronics in digital chips that are the basis for the information revolution that has transformed the world.
You say that your concerns about the environment help lead you to this line of science that eventually became nanotechnology.
Yeah. Well, my main primary concern in my life from a very early time, high school actually, has been the future of our industrial civilization. And back then, which was around the time of the first Earth Day, people were beginning to wonder whether that was going to work out very well or not. And today we're seeing some signs of rather grave difficulties in resources and the Earth's limited ability to tolerate what we're doing to it, including, of course, carbon emissions.
Well, politics always gets involved in these things, especially when we're talking about funding. In the year 2000, a while back, before austerity became the word du jour, Congress passed a nanotechnology initiative. Has that changed much in the field? Has it changed much about how the public thinks of nanotechnology?
I think that it has contributed to confusion because of the diffuseness of the term. Much of what nanotechnology refers to is simple particles and things. So the kinds of technologies that I've been exploring and describing are based on machines that can move, for example, molecules, bring them together to build additional structures, complex structures, very much like a factory on a chip, if you will. And a lot of what is nanotechnology today, it's nano and it's technology, is more like little rocks. If you imagine confusing a rock with a pocket watch, similar in size, but how similar are they in their technological nature, in their function, structure, level of technology? They're utterly different. And nanotechnology can refer today equally well to something that's the equivalent of the rock or something that's the equivalent of a pocket watch.
Is this idea similar to 3D printing?
There are strong analogies with 3D printing. It's an example that we have today of using computer digital information to build intricate structures from small bits of material. But if you take the small bits of material down to the scale of molecules, then the products can be higher quality than anything we see in the world today. Faster computers, higher performance photovoltaic, stronger materials, and really a radical change in performance.
Well, my only frames of reference are science fiction. Is this like the replicator in Star Trek?
I think that the replicator in Star Trek is a science fiction idea that derived from ideas that derived from popular culture ideas that came from my 1986 book, actually. It pretty clearly traces back.
My guest is K. Eric Drexler, whose latest book is Radical Abundance, How a Revolution in Nanotechnology Will Change Civilization. It's published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Forgive me for not being all that scientific, but I know what atoms are. But where would the atoms for this technology be coming from? We have yeast floating all around the world, in the air. We have atoms floating in the air, but we're not going to be capturing the atoms, are we, to do this?
We live in a world made of atoms, and how the atoms are arranged makes a tremendous difference. It's the difference between coal and diamond. It's the difference between silicon in sand and silicon in semiconductor chips. It's the difference between sickness and health also. In terms of raw materials, well, as I say, everything's made of atoms, and the input to a atomically precise manufacturing process would be atomically precise structures. Well, what? Simple molecules. Water, the kinds of hydrocarbons you might find in mineral oil, simple salts and oxides. And those materials are common. They are, of course, made of atoms and molecules. And an industrial process that uses those inputs as the parts, the components that are put together to make larger parts, that are put together to make larger parts, can smoothly and rapidly go from these inexpensive, atomically precise molecules to macroscopic products at very low cost. And that has transformative potential. That's part of what I explore in Radical Abundance, because I think it's important for people to understand the prospects. Changes the sense of what the 21st century can be.
Well, what would this look like, the manufacturing process? Would an APM system be big, like the mainframe computers that used to take up whole rooms?
Well, the size, if you run through the engineering description, turns out to be comparable to the size of the product. If you want products that you can hold in your hand or put on a desk, a desktop size machine like a desktop printer is the right kind of machine to envision.
But I'd need a big one to make my own automobile.
And if you want to make an automobile, it's a system about the size of a garage.
Uh-huh. And then if I want to make an airplane, better have a big space.
Either a big space, or you make sections of the wing and the tail and so on, and make them so that they snap together.
How do you minimize errors in an APM system? Can't you inadvertently misarrange the atoms?
Well, that's a key engineering parameter is what is the error rate in these operations? In the nanoelectronics that we're using right now to speak to the audience, there are nanoscale devices that work at very high frequencies, and they make errors at a very, very low rate. And the reason is that bits either are set to 1 or set to 0. There's no in-between point. It's a similar story with atoms and molecules. You have bonds or you don't have bonds. And so if the accuracy is good enough to be on one side of the threshold reliably, you get a precise result. And that's one of the characteristics that's special and parallel between atomically precise manufacturing, which, as I've said, can be thought of as a lot like a factory on a chip, and digital logic. The physics, in deep down abstract sense, is actually very parallel.
But would the fact that the components are so small lead to greater precision in the end?
The precision essentially comes from the granular, precise nature of matter. Atoms of a particular element are chemically identical. They're the same size, shape, they form the same bonds. And if you have the right kind of atom and you form the right bonds, you have a definite result. And if you put small pieces together that have that precision, and you put them together accurately, you have a precise larger structure, which can be put together to make larger precise structures with advantages in the properties.
Well, doesn't what you're talking about fly in the face of Henry Ford's assembly lines and industrialized production, which helped bring down production costs in the early 20th century? Or does it take that principle and reduce it to an individual scale?
Well, the prospect is for having extraordinarily productive manufacturing systems that could be on a personal level, on a local level, very short supply chains. And well, think of the pervasive nature of modern electronic technologies. Once upon a time, you had, as you mentioned earlier, computer systems that would fill a room. If you took one of today's chips and you built the same complexity with 1950s technology, it would be the size of a small city. So nanotechnology in the electronic world has taken systems that were filling a room or would have filled a city and put them into your pocket in a cell phone. The prospect here is of putting that kind of complexity, the complexity of a factory system, into a very small package and convenient and the sort of thing that you can have throughout Africa as cell phones are now found throughout Africa.
Well, what changed the nature of computering? Mm-hmm. Computerization was the printed circuit, wasn't it? Mm. Because that eliminated the need to take a whole bunch of wires and solder them all together. But that's not nanotechnology, is it?
Well, printed circuits aren't, but the pattern, what you're describing here of laying down devices and conductive paths on a surface, is the same principle you find in chips, where we now have billions of transistors across the surface of a single chip. So now, it is analogous to what you're saying and is on a nanoscale.
And, of course, a lot of people would be put out of work if this thing works.
One of the reasons that I felt it was important to explore and describe prospects for these technologies and to make it very clear and from multiple points of view, historical, technological analogies to past technological revolutions, some of the history of ideas. What that really leads up to is a description of disruptive solutions to global problems, problems of global economic development, and how to reconcile that with the collision between industrial civilization and the limits of Earth, and reframe the problems of the 21st century and raise some new ones, the problems of abundance, the problems of a real explosion in material technology, which raises questions of, international supply chains and trade and raw materials, radical transformations, employment, as you said. And, of course, as every new powerful technology has done, extensions in the potential range of military systems. And that raises questions of international strategic stability, arms control, and what do national interests look like in a world where there is simultaneously a profound transformation of economics. And part of my message is that one has to look at those together. The national interests will change at the same time that technologies enable new means of projecting force. And I think that a rational assessment of hardcore national self-interest around the world can lead to a sense that what is needed is stability and not attempts at conquest, because there is much less to be gained and a lot to be lost.
Well, you're also suggesting that we would equalize the playing field around the world, because any people could do this all over the world. We wouldn't have the haves and the have-nots. But it seems to me that something this complex could be prohibitively expensive. Why do you say that APM would end up lowering production costs?
The book runs through a description of that. First, you have to have a sense of what the technology is. I'm trying to think, what did I go through in this analysis that leads to that conclusion? Essentially, if you ask what are the costs of products, you have costs of labor, costs of materials, costs of energy, land, capital equipment, and externalities, the implicit costs of pollution and risk and so on. You can go through that list point by point and find, let's say, the labor requirements are slashed, the raw materials requirements are low, the energy requirements are low, and the cost of the capital equipment is the cost of these atomically precise manufacturing systems, the desktop printer-like boxes or larger systems. But they themselves are products of the same kind of manufacturing process. And it's a very
high... So we could build them by using this atomically precise manufacturing process.
And a technology that has low energy requirements, low material requirements, and high throughput, the ability to have a lot of product per, many kilograms of product per kilogram of machine per day. You run that through, look at the loop of cost reduction due to the low cost of production of the machines that do the production. You conclude that the products look like, $1 per kilogram is a reasonable range.
My guest is K. Eric Drexler, who developed and named the concepts of nanotechnology and atomically precise manufacturing, APM, and brought them to the attention of a broad audience. He is currently with the Oxford Martin School at Oxford University, and his latest book is Radical Abundance: How a Revolution in Nanotechnology Will Change Civilization. It's published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had in May with K. Eric Drexler, whose latest book is Radical Abundance: How a Revolution in Nanotechnology Will Change Civilization. All of this kind of sounds like something out of a science fiction novel, but you point out that we've seen similar revolutions in how we listen to music, print words, and talk to each other. But those things were developed pretty quickly because the science was, it now seems, pretty simple. What about something like creating an APM system?
The scientific principles are thoroughly understood. In fact, the point of my work has been to ask a different question from the one that's usually asked. The question is, what are the technological implications of solid, standard textbook science? You ask a series of questions that are sort of the sorts of questions that might have you might find at the end of a chapter in a textbook, but the answers are of engineering importance. So you take known engineering principles, established science, and ask, what can be built in accord with those, but with tools that we don't have yet? So APM technologies at this point are very well understood. They can be modeled in atomic detail with standard computational tools that are used in the molecular sciences. But what we don't have is the ability to build them. What we have is tools that can be used to build better tools that can be used to build better tools. Once upon a time, people had tools that were stone. And with tools of stone, they shaped wood and other tools of stone and learned to build fires and smelt metals and make hammers and made their way forward through blacksmithing on through the technologies of the Industrial Revolution.
So where were we in regard to nanotechnology? At the Stone Age or the Bronze Age?
I would say that we're essentially at the blacksmithing era and
so the Iron Age.
And moving toward steel and machines very rapidly. And the difference, of course, is that today we have computational simulation, research and development establishments, and the generations of technology pass more quickly than human generations.
When you were an undergraduate at MIT, you were drawn to the idea of harnessing outer space to help sustain future generations. How would that have worked? And that's a far cry from what you're talking about now, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the motivation, again, was the constraints of our industrial civilization and the Earth. And at the time, NASA was promising to drop the cost of spaceflight by a factor of 10 or more, and that didn't happen, which took many of the plans and dreams that were in the aerospace engineering community at the time and put them on hold for some time. But what I learned from my work at MIT in space systems engineering was how to think about large-scale projects that would take decades, perhaps, to complete, that could be analyzed in a quantitative way using known engineering principles, known scientific principles, and lead to new results, including the ability to make things in a new environment and in new ways.
When Jaron Lanier was here earlier today, you know Jaron.
Yes.
We talked about innovation, and he said, every technology has side effects which have to be undone. Is it possible to know what the side effects of atomically precise manufacturing would be?
Well, there are two levels to consider side effects. One level is the inadvertent side effects. The sort
we can't always predict.
Indeed. And one, you do better if you try than if you don't, but you must have absolute confidence that you will not completely succeed, and often not even remotely. The great unknowns in this case, I think, are in the range of applications that people haven't thought of yet and the responses and decisions of human societies at the economic level, the social level, the political level. the technology themselves are as benign and controlled in physical terms as microelectronics is. You know, a computer on a chip, factory on a chip, both very, very controlled and precise, and yet computation has had implications that no one could have predicted.
Well, with computers, we've wound up creating all sorts of other problems. For example, a lot of the materials involved are toxic. We don't know what to do with them when we throw them away. Would there be any toxicity involved in the materials used here?
Well, in this case, the technology is really about controlling what is done with the materials, and if that includes controlling the form of all of the outputs. So what goes in has to come out, and it either comes out in products or it comes out as waste. But the waste materials are materials that went in the first place. They're not new, and they can be put into whatever the most benign form is. For example, if you had minerals coming in, well, you anything that you have left over that you don't want to use, you can put out as another kind of stable geological mineral. There's no reason to release particles into the air or dissolve toxic materials in water. That can be avoided as a consequence of the control of the process itself.
Where's the funding for this research coming from?
Well, the first question is, what is the research and where is it? By and large, it's not called nanotechnology. It is work that's being done in the molecular sciences in areas that had names before the concept of nanotechnology emerged, and the names are names like chemistry, molecular biology, more or less contemporaneous protein engineering. And those fields have been undergoing surprisingly rapid progress, somewhat under the radar because they're atomically precise fabrication. They're the pathway that I outlined in 1981 in my first scientific paper is through those technologies. But because they're not called nanotechnology, attention has been elsewhere. So many billions of dollars are going into that technology base, but it has been largely oriented toward other objectives, and its applications have not been as well recognized as they should be.
Well, is the government involved, or are we seeing mostly private involvements? Is the research being done at universities? Should we be concerned about who is involved in developing this?
The current situation is rather peculiar in historical terms. There has been a tangle of confusion around the word, around the technologies, around the contrast between the pathways and some of the objectives. And the resulting situation is one of a lack of focus in these areas. Surprising progress in the technologies that will make these developments possible. But the work is being done by scientists in small teams, largely for other purposes. What I think is about to happen, from what I understand in responses to discussions and conferences and some other venues, is the emergence of a focus of systems engineering in the molecular world. We haven't really seen that. At this point, the technology base is ripe for that, but it's going to require a social and cultural change, institutional changes, in the molecular sciences. And as I say in the book, the key challenges today are not technical. They're cultural and institutional.
Getting politicians on board, for example?
Not primarily politicians. Politicians in around the year 2000 funded...
A different Congress.
Different Congress, but you look worldwide, similar developments occurred. There were billions of dollars of funding directed toward quote-unquote nanotechnology. And almost all of it went to a different spectrum of nanotechnologies. Very worthy research, rewarding. It's good that it's funded. But it's almost perfectly at right angles to the line of development that leads to APM. So instead, we've seen the progress largely in the molecular sciences. So the lesson there is that there has already been an enormous investment, which, if you look at the language of the bills and so on, was clearly aimed at accomplishing some of the goals that I laid out in 1986. I think that a renewed understanding of how to get there and an understanding of how far the technologies have come will lead to quite ample funding. This is actually not very expensive research. Quite ample funding to move forward on these paths.
You mentioned Karl Popper in your book, The Scientific Philosopher. Has his idea that science can't ever provide a universally quantified theory guided your approach to your work?
It's a key epistemological point in understanding the physical sciences. Part of why it's important to understand that is because it highlights how different engineering is. In science, one experiment can't prove a universal principle because there can always be some exception elsewhere. But in engineering, one demonstration is enough to prove that something will work. And that is a fundamental, if you will, a logical level of difference in the nature of knowledge in science and engineering. And another topic in the book is the relationship between science and engineering at a conceptual level, at the level of knowledge, how that intertwines with the very contrasting cultures in science and engineering, and how that has created friction, well, in many parts of our technological society, but in particular on pathways in this area.
But we're going to have to deal with issues like, on the political level, with diplomacy, where different countries are going to have to iron these things out if we ever get to a point where we are creating things through APM systems.
These are the sorts of concerns that naturally rise to the level of international cooperation and competition. And how that plays out will be critical to the future. You mentioned earlier a vision of having these productive technologies applied to raising the standards of living, solving material problems around the world.
They'll have a huge effect on global trade, won't they?
And they can have these effects, but it depends very much on human choices.
Well, if I'm able to make a tablet computer in my own home, then every person who works on those sorts of things in Asia would be put out of work.
Indeed. And a technology that brings abundance and economic disruption together could paradoxically lead to massive poverty because of the unemployment caused by rapid restructuring of industry. At the same time that the productivity per capita, potential productivity per capita, goes into the stratosphere. So I think that we're going to see occasions when the change is more rapid than the economic mechanisms have really been dealing with previously, and some forethought, some use the word planning here, whether formal or informal, is important.
Do you see this as a utopian vision, or some people might say a dystopian vision?
I see it as what the principles of science and engineering tell us is the potential of technology, which is a quantitative, physical thing. It's independent of history or what human beings do. And then given that, which again comes out of, you know, quantifiable physical engineering reality, which is the same. The potential of technology is the same today as it was a billion years ago because physical law is the same. But in terms of utopia versus dystopia, well, in human history, things seem to have been by and large improving. Perhaps that trend will continue.
There are always dire predictions when something new comes along.
Yes. And it's, I think, very useful to consider dire possibilities and how to avoid them, and not be fatalistic, not to be blindly optimistic or pessimistic, but to consider the spectrum of possibilities and to try to form a shared understanding of problems that can lead to solutions.
Do you have a sense of how much energy would be required to get an APM system to create an object, or would we be creating the energy through the APM system that would then be used? I'm thinking about what happens to Saudi Arabia or any place that produces oil, for example, or all of the places, coal. For example, we wouldn't need them anymore, would we?
Well, if you ask what is the bottleneck in deploying solar photovoltaics today as one of the primary sources of renewable energy, it's a manufacturing problem. It's a problem of taking matter and energy in modest amounts and converting them into thin sheets of the right kind of material. APM technologies can provide a new way of doing that, making photovoltaics as inexpensive as, I don't know, cardboard and aluminum foil. And at that kind of cost, coal fire plants become thoroughly uneconomical. You tend to drive them out of business simply because the costs of doing generating energy that way are very high. Demand for petroleum essentially goes away if you want fuels and hydrocarbon fuels are very convenient, especially for aviation. Well, you can synthesize them with zero net carbon footprint because you can take the carbon out of the atmosphere.
Now, when I asked you earlier, how close are we to actually being able to implement this kind of technology? You said, well, we're at the blacksmith stage. So how long do you think it will be before I'll be holding an anatomically precise manufactured object in my hand?
Well, physics and engineering can't predict human action and rate of progress, I think, surprisingly rapidly is one answer if you look at the stages of technology and what computational modeling can do. One answer is before the seas rise much further. And I think it's important to take that perspective because we are facing problems on a scale, on a planetary scale, that can't be fixed with the industrial technology that created them. This scale of productive technology can provide the means to reverse the accumulation of greenhouse gases, which ordinarily, without this kind of intervention, would take on the order of centuries to normalize. One can outline scenarios that take it back down in 10 years.
So it would be a non-polluting process.
The opposite of polluting process, getting CO2 levels back to the pre-industrial level. So one shouldn't count on being able to do that this way, but it's a definite prospect.
K. Eric Drexler's book, Radical Abundance, How a Revolution in Nanotechnology Will Change Civilization, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.